Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick O'Shaughnessy at History Chappy on social media. Today, we are absolutely delighted to be joined by Professor David Vine, who's the Professor of Anthropology at the American University. David has just published a brand new book entitled The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State, published by the University of California Press. And I think the paperback is out in the fall or the autumn of this year. David, how are you? Thanks for joining us. Tell us everything.
Patrick, thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you, and seems like a really exciting podcast. The paperback for my book, The United States of War, indeed is out in the fall or autumn in September. The audiobook just came out, and I'm excited to get a chance to talk about a book that I think is, and I hope is, as relevant as ever. There is some attention to the United States withdrawal from Afghanistan that President Biden has promised by the 9/11 anniversary or 11 September anniversary. But a lot of people think that, with that war, quote unquote, over, that we can sort of forget about war. But my book shows how the United States, in profound ways, is a United States of War, has been a United States of War, that is a nation defined by war since its independence, and will remain so, whether U.S. troops fully withdraw from Afghanistan by 11 September or not. Unfortunately, there is a massive infrastructure of U.S. military bases and U.S. troops surrounding Afghanistan. There are signs that there may be a considerable U.S. military or U.S. presence that remains in Afghanistan itself. And the United States will still be engaged in combat in other countries, perhaps as many as 10 other countries. My book points attention to this larger pattern of war and calls for dramatic change, because I, for one, am to say that I'm saddened by the U.S. history of war is a profound understatement. And I think the United States needs to change dramatically in how it engages with the rest of the world. And if it doesn't, I think the days of U.S. empire, the days of the United States as an empire, are numbered. I hope the days of the United States as an empire are numbered, but I would like to see the United States de-imperialize itself in a way that does not bring about future wars and additional destruction, but instead is an orderly process of again, changing fundamentally the way the United States engages with the world, moving away from a form of engagement that has revolved around war to a form of engagement that revolves around diplomacy and peace building and violence reduction.
Thank you, David. Okay, a question that always gets our listeners, especially those that want to engage with history and perhaps perchance write some. How did you go about researching this new book then? And why is this particular history so necessary right now? And where does it sort of slot in or synchronize or challenge the pre-existing historiographical canon or the pre-existing historiographical debates on the topic? Quite a loaded question, so I'll just repeat it. How did you research it? Why is it necessary, and where does it fit in to the current historiography on the topic?
So the book, The United States of War, is really the result of 20 years of research almost to the day. 20 years ago in August, I began research about one U.S. military base, a military base that both the British and U.S. governments deeply involved in the history, the base on the island Diego Garcia, the island in the middle of the Indian Ocean that Britain continues to control, and on which there is a massive U.S. Air Force and Navy base. And roughly now 20 years ago, I got invited to conduct some research about the history of the base on Diego Garcia and the little known story of the indigenous Chagosian people who once lived on Diego Garcia and the surrounding Chagos Islands, or Chagos Islands, as sometimes it's heard in Britain. I conducted research documenting the effects of the expulsion of the Chagosians. So during the creation of the US military base on Diego Garcia, the British and US governments forcibly removed the entire indigenous Chagosian people from their homes and deported them about 1,200 miles, about 2,000 kilometers away to the Western Indian Ocean islands of Mauritius and the Seychelles. And unsurprisingly, the Chagosians became deeply impoverished in exile. They were given no resettlement assistance. And the Chagosians were suing both the British and US governments and needed a researcher to do some research. And I was more than happy to help. I just started a PhD in anthropology and spent the next several years documenting the effects of the expulsion on the Chagosians' lives, and then also expanding beyond what the Chagosians and their lawyers asked to investigate why it was that the United States built a military base on the Chagosians' largest island, Diego Garcia, why US military officials thought it was appropriate to displace this entire people, dump them in exile. Why the United States needed and needs a military base in the middle of the Indian Ocean in the first place, which then led me to ask larger questions about the whole collection of US military bases around the world. I, like most people in the United States, knew little of an entire world of military bases that the United States government maintains around the globe. Currently, there are about 800 US military bases outside the 50 states in Washington, DC, about 800 bases in around 83 countries and colonies. And the precise numbers are unknown because there's so little transparency that the US military maintains. But I began to ask larger questions about this collection of bases, what they're doing. Are they protecting the United States? Are they protecting global security in any sense? Are they making the world more secure, safer? Or indeed, are they damaging lives, as the base on Diego Garcia clearly had damaged the lives of the Chagosians? And my initial research about Diego Garcia led to a book called Island of Shame, and then led to some larger research about this whole collection of roughly 800 US military bases abroad, outside the 50 states and Washington, D.C., which led to a book called Base Nation. And then after I finished that, I realized that there was sort of a bigger puzzle that I wanted to understand and make an intervention in. And that is the larger system of war. US military bases abroad have many effects, often quite damaging effects on local people living around the bases. They have a range of damaging effects on the non-human environment. They have effects that are social, cultural, economic, political, but bases also enable war. And that the last 20 years of endless wars, or forever wars, some people sometimes refer to it as the global war on terror, has been enabled by this huge collection of US military bases that encircle the globe. And that's what that system of bases and the larger system of war is what my book, The United States of War, takes on. And, you know, initially I was pretty focused on the last 20 years of war, the wars in now at least 24 countries that U.S. combat troops have been engaged in war or some other form of combat since 2001. But as I began to research deeper, I realized that there's really nothing exceptional at all about this period of continuous war since 2001. That in fact, through US history, there are very few years in which the United States military has not been engaged in one war or another or some form of combat. In fact, in 234 out of the 245 years in US history, the U.S. military has been engaged in a war or some other form of combat. So war is the norm in U.S. history, and that is part of, you know, the central argument of the book, The United States of War. In the United States, and this is true in Britain, I think, to some extent, and elsewhere, but in the United States, war often gets talked about, written about by historians, written about in school history texts as a heroic endeavor, as something that can be glorious. And I think this is profoundly misleading. And my book attempts to change that narrative and change in many ways the narrative of the entire history of the United States. But first and foremost, we have to remember that war is about destruction and the taking of human lives. And my book, unlike other histories of war, focuses on the human effects of US wars through history. And in fact, I begin my history before the creation of the United States, before the U.S. independence from Britain. I think it's important to take the history back at least to the arrival of Columbus and in the Americas. And by doing so, we see that the United States emerges out of a history of European colonization in the Americas. And the United States becomes an empire that emerges out of European empires and supersedes European empires in the Americas. And in that imperial context, we can begin to understand why the United States government has so continuously engaged in warfare to expand the boundaries of the United States, to seize territory, to conquer other peoples, to seize natural resources and other profit-making opportunities, not for the sake of the U.S. government itself per se, but often for a group of elites and business interests. So we see some clear patterns through U.S. history that wars are not fought just for the sake of war, but almost always are fought for very specific economic and political ends. So that's the sort of larger history that I'm trying to tell, and the context in which I'm trying to place the last 20 years of war in.
Thank you very much, David. Absolutely fascinating. I've just been sitting here scratching my head thinking about the podcast that we've done. I think we've covered the French and Indian War, Seven Years' War, the American Revolution, the War of 1812, the American Civil War, World War I, World War II, and Vietnam. And I think we've touched on the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, but not the recent American conflict. So here on the Versus History podcast, we've talked about the Americans and war quite a bit. So I suppose that chimes with what you've been talking about to some extent. So the next question then, what is the historical context to the US's military involvement in Afghanistan? Are there any continuities or correlations to the failed Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, I think, which started on Christmas Day 1979, right up until their withdrawal 10 years later in 1989? Over to you.
Well, I think there are several pieces of important historical context. One in the biggest scope is a history of empires attempting to conquer and occupy Afghanistan and failing, dating to, at very least, to Alexander the Great, but certainly the British experience in Afghanistan ends in retreat and failure. The Soviet occupation of Afghanistan ends in retreat and failure. And as many people warned US leaders from the beginning, from 2001, the United States military will leave Afghanistan, having brought about little that one could celebrate, instead having contributed to a long period of war that dates to at least the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, and a long period of displacement and destruction and death. The US involvement in Afghanistan dates to actually before the Soviet invasion in 1979. In fact, President Carter's national security advisor talked about later, luring the Soviet Union into a trap to give the Soviet Union its own Vietnam. This is in the wake of the disastrous U.S. war in Vietnam and Southeast Asia, Laos, Cambodia. The aim was to give the Soviet Union its own Afghanistan its own Vietnam in Afghanistan. And this involved a long period during which the U.S. government funded and backed Mujahideen rebels that would come to take on the Soviet occupiers and eventually help to evict the Soviet Union from Afghanistan. This, of course, led the United States to ally itself with Osama bin Laden, none other than, who went on to found Al-Qaeda. But in his guise as a Mujahideen rebel in Afghanistan, the CIA backed him and other rebels and fueled the war, the civil war there, that continued after the Soviet withdrawal. There was a period when the United States largely turned away from Afghanistan after the Soviet withdrawal, after the end of the Cold War. But the attacks of 9/11 were, of course, followed by the George W. Bush administration's decision to invade Afghanistan and overthrow the Taliban government, a decision that was never inevitable, but was one that was very much a choice to invade a country that had virtually nothing to do with the attacks of 11 September. The Taliban had given Al-Qaeda some small areas to conduct training and other to maintain military bases. But the Taliban government had nothing to do with the Al-Qaeda's attacks of 11 September. Similarly, the people of Afghanistan had nothing to do with the attacks of 11 September. They had no responsibility for the attacks and yet have suffered the effects of the U.S. war and U.S. occupation of Afghanistan in numbers far, far, far exceeding the numbers who were killed or injured on 11 September. In fact, on all sides in Afghanistan in the last 20 years of war, there are likely around 1 million people who've died on all sides, combatants and civilians alike. Around 9 million people have been displaced in that period. And meanwhile, the United States has spent upwards of $2 trillion, which is really an unfathomable amount of money. And if we should think about how else that money could have been spent, that just, in my mind, compounds the profound catastrophe of the last 20 years of war.
What were the initial aims of the US military intervention in Afghanistan dating back to 2001? And to what extent, objectively speaking, do you think they have been achieved? Did the aims evolve as time went on? Have there been any unexpected side effects that weren't included in their aims, but that have occurred anyway, either for better or probably for worse? So did they actually achieve what they intended to do by intervening militarily?
So I think there were several initial aims, spoken and unspoken. The immediate spoken aim was to destroy Al-Qaeda. And that aim was not achieved. Al-Qaeda leaders and militants fled Afghanistan into Pakistan. Many of them, of course, were killed. Meanwhile, thousands, tens of thousands of Afghan civilians and others were also killed in that process. I think there's another aim that probably doesn't get enough attention. I think there's a strong, and we see this through U.S. history and the history of U.S. wars, that I think there were some gender dynamics afoot, that war has been a way to prove the manliness or supposed manliness of U.S. leaders. And I think U.S. leaders, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, who was the most powerful vice president in U.S. history by far, and other U.S. leaders, in many ways, I suspect, couldn't contemplate or had great difficulty contemplating a reaction to the attacks of 11 September short of war. In fact, research shows that in terms of the effectiveness of responding to terrorist acts, war is a very ineffective response. That responses rooted in criminal justice approaches and intelligence gathering are far more effective around the world than responding with war. But the Bush administration, the Bush-Cheney administration, responded with war, I think, in some ways to reassert a kind of manliness and reputation, having felt the blow of the attacks of 11 September. In some ways, I think they felt some deep need to respond with war, to reassert the power of the United States. So I think that along with the sort of more immediate aim of uprooting and destroying Al-Qaeda. Over time, indeed, the aims of the U.S. war in Afghanistan merged and melded, and they always, you know, trotted out some other justifications for the war, including, you know, protecting the rights of women, which were actually, you know, also has a deep history dating to at least the British Empire's occupation of Afghanistan and Southern Asia, South Asia. But these were, I think, mostly part of a public relations campaign to justify the U.S. invasion and war in Afghanistan. I think there were many, many side effects. I hesitate to call them side effects, of course, because, you know, the first and foremost, the effects of the U.S. war and now 20 years of war in Afghanistan, the major effects have been that, again, the death of around a million people, injuries to surely many millions more, as I mentioned, 9 million displaced roughly, and untold other destruction. The attempts at reconstruction and development in Afghanistan have largely been fairly disastrous, have fueled corruption in the country, and have again resulted in the waste of and squandering of tens of billions of dollars, surely. So it is a really, it's difficult to find words to capture the catastrophe of the last 20 years of U.S. war in Afghanistan, the complete disaster that it represents.
Thank you, David. Okay, quite a large question in terms of chronology and scope. You can take it as you wish. You can take it all the way back to the American Revolution. What have the costs of American wars been in terms of finances, social costs, cultural costs, political, environmental? It's quite a big question. So if you want to localize it to one or two conflicts, you are, of course, more than welcome. Over to you.
It is a difficult and really important question. I think, again, first and foremost, I would point to the human costs, the death that U.S. wars have resulted in. First and foremost, I think we probably have to focus on the long series of U.S. wars, U.S. government wars against Native American peoples and nations from the end of the 18th century throughout most of the 19th century. There are different estimates in terms of the numbers of Native American peoples who died as a result of the U.S. Colonization of across North America, but surely they number in the millions that were killed, murdered, displaced, and so, again, immense amounts of suffering inflicted. Again, there was, well, some of the justification for U.S. wars has invoked this term manifest destiny, an idea that you know, essentially the that that the expansion of the United States and the wars that accompanied that expansion were destined by God, were inevitable. But there was never anything inevitable about the expansion of the United States, about US wars. There was nothing inevitable at them. These were wars that were chosen by US leaders, powerful US leaders, who chose war to expand the boundaries of the United States, to expand profit-making opportunities for elites, for businesses, as I mentioned before. And in the process, again, the costs have been disastrous for the people who've suffered, who include, in my mind, the members of the U.S. military who were enlisted and sent to fight a long series of U.S. wars. So I count them among the victims, in addition to other combatants and millions upon millions of civilians. As many of your listeners know, after the long series of, there are too many wars, in short, there are too many wars to mention them all. And I guess for that reason, I would encourage people to read my book, The United States of War. It is not an exhaustive telling of every single war in US history, but instead is trying to point to the larger patterns of war that have shaped why the United States has fought wars so continuously and throughout. I try to point to, again, the costs that you've asked about, the human effects, first and foremost, of these wars. The United States has exercised, the US government has exercised immense power throughout the Western hemispheres, in Latin America. Beginning of the 20th century, the United States essentially decided to turn away from the formal seizure of territories and colonies as it did throughout the 19th century, part of the conquest of territory across North America, and then the conquest of territories outside of North America, especially in the 1898 war with what remained of the Spanish Empire that led to the U.S. conquest of the Philippines, the seizure of Guam, the conquest of Puerto Rico, and the conquest of Cuba, which became a sort of de facto U.S. colony, even though it formally had independence. After that, the U.S. leaders turned away from the formal acquisition of colonies, as many of the U.S. As many of the European empires did as well, but instead engaged in a long series of invasions and long-term, often occupations of Latin American countries, again, almost always in the interests of U.S. businesses who had economic interests in Central and South America, in the Caribbean. To get back to your question about the costs, the costs have extended, I think, beyond just the deaths, the destruction. I think, and this is one of the things I try to convey in the title of my book, The United States of War, that the United States is a United States of War in the sense that war has shaped U.S. citizens as people in ways that are both seen and unseen, that it has shaped how we see the rest of the world, how we engage with the rest of the world, how we think about even matters of security, and has shaped our lives in profound ways. So that is to say that the costs of U.S. wars have not just been borne by combatants, have not just been borne by the people in the countries where the U.S. military has fought, which almost always has been in other countries. The World War II is really an exception in U.S. history. The U.S. wars had been offensive in nature. They have not been defensive in nature. The attack of the Japanese Empire on the United States was the rare exception where the U.S. military responded to an attack. But beyond the effects of U.S. wars on civilians and combatants alike, I think people in the United States especially need to, I hope, appreciate the ways in which orienting U.S. society and the U.S. government around war, around preparations for war, and especially the immense sums of money that, the U.S. government has plowed into this system of war, especially since World War II, that this has shaped U.S. society in profound and fundamental ways. And thus, the society we live in today is not one that was ever a given. The reason the United States does not have the social welfare states that you see in Europe, in most of Europe, and in most of the other wealthy countries of the world, is because the United States, especially since World War II, has built a warfare state, as some have called it, have built a state, a country that is focused, has focused its energies, its finances around the production of war and preparations for war. And this has come at the expense of a state that would take care of U.S. citizens, providing the basic protections and safety net that people in other wealthy industrialized countries take for granted.
Okay, next question. Some historians absolutely hate these, as I'm sure you're aware, Dave, because it's counterfactual, but I'll give you the question and see what you make of it. If you could go back in time then to aid President Bush at the time of the initial American intervention in Afghanistan in 2001, what advice would you give him, given the fact that you have obviously the benefit of hindsight?
I would give President Bush the same advice that many people gave him in the days after 11 September. I would say the exact same thing, which is, that is, don't go to war. Don't respond to these attacks with war. In fact, that gave Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda exactly what they wanted. It inflated the reputation of Al-Qaeda. The attacks were dramatically more successful than just as violent attacks than Al-Qaeda anticipated. But then to give Al-Qaeda the war that it sought was, a profound error. But people from the days after the attacks themselves were urging the United States not to go to war, not to go to war, and instead to respond to the attacks as the crimes that they were. And that is to say, to respond to them with criminal justice responses and with intelligence gathering, which is how the United States had responded to other attacks. Al-Qaeda's likely attacks on the World Trade Center in the 1990s, other attacks, and to go to war first in Afghanistan, but then to create a far, far broader war on terror, really, I think there's it's difficult to imagine a more significant catastrophe in U.S. history, a more significant catastrophe in U.S. foreign policy. And the catastrophe is, of course, not just been one for the United States, but instead it's been a gigantic catastrophe for the greater Middle East and for the entire world. In its total, if we look at the total effects of the U.S. global war on terror, of the endless wars or forever wars that have been fought now for almost 20 years without cessation, in the five most violent wars the United States has fought, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, the overlapping war there, in Iraq, in Yemen, and the part of the war in Syria that the United States has been involved in, there are probably around 4 million people on all sides who've died in these wars. 4 million people in the eight most violent wars the United States has been involved in, with a group of American university students, I estimated that around 37 million people have likely been displaced. Tens of millions of people have been injured in the U.S. wars since the attacks of 11 September. So, again, there were people from the very beginning who were urging the Bush administration not to respond to war. Sadly for the world, the Bush administration chose war And the results have been, again, beyond catastrophic.
The final question from me then, also one that some historians hate, but obviously as historians, we cannot lobotomize citizenship. So here's the question. Given the past and what we know about it and the present, what does the future hold, do you think, for American military involvement in Afghanistan and American military endeavors generally? Over to you.
I think the United States is at a really critical turning point. I think the world is at a critical turning point in many ways. The Biden administration's announcement that it would withdraw troops from Afghanistan is a very encouraging sign. It's something that should have been done years and years and years ago. Should have been done, again, I think that the war shouldn't have happened in the first place. But surely troops should have been withdrawn by the Obama-Biden administration. So the Biden administration has a choice to withdraw troops and pretty much otherwise maintain the status quo of war, U.S. combat troops in around 10 other countries, or it can really bring the endless wars, the forever wars, the global war on terror to a final end and reorient the United States toward a productive and engagement with the rest of the world that isn't oriented around war, but instead is, as I mentioned at the outset, oriented around peace building, violence reduction, diplomacy. That, of course, is what I very much would like to see and I'm calling for, along with people across the political spectrum. It is encouraging that, you know, I fully identify as someone on the political left in the United States, but there are people across the political spectrum in the United States who have long ago grown tired of this long history of interventionist imperialist wars, and have called for a new path. And there are many encouraging signs that this is becoming part of mainstream foreign policy discourses in the United States. So I don't think that my call for a fundamental reorientation of U.S. foreign policy and an end to this endless fighting is just utopian. The Biden administration has a choice and can pursue a profoundly different path. And I one of my greatest fears is if they instead choose to maintain the status quo, that the United States will plunge into even more catastrophic wars. And the kind of warmongering we hear now, the kind of rhetoric about China is truly frightening. There are people in the Chinese government who also bear responsibility, but there are very troubling signs that there are people in the U.S. government, in the U.S. military, who see a war with China as virtually inevitable. There are people, put aside China, there are far too many so-called leaders who are, you know, talking about future U.S. wars. And in my mind, it is really inconceivable that war could be seen as a legitimate policy option given the past 20 years of catastrophic war. War should not be a legitimate policy option for the United States, should not be a legitimate policy option for any country, but especially for the United States, given the death and destruction that our wars have caused in the last 20 years alone. And the idea that there are people in the United States and some in China and elsewhere who are anticipating a war between these two nuclear armed powers is again beyond frightening. That people could even conceive of a clash, and that even a small clash wouldn't spiral out of control into a potentially nuclear exchange, and that would make the immense catastrophe and disaster of the last 20 years of war possibly look small, given the tens of millions of people who could die in a war between the United States and China. Avoiding such a war, avoiding a war between the United States and China, has to be at the top of a list of priorities for anyone who cares about peace in the world, and avoiding all future U.S. wars, in addition to ending the current wars, these have to be the priorities for the Biden administration in my mind.
Well, President Biden, if you're listening, I hope you've taken heed of that. Everyone, I think, echoes David's sentiments there. If we could avoid a war with China, avoid war generally, that would be a coup for the world. Thank you very much, David Vine. His new book entitled The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to Islamic State is out now, published by the University of California Press. And if you want to hold on for the paperback, that will be out in the fall of this year. David, that really was an epic, a tour de force. I love the way it combined as the international relations, politics and history as well in a really unique and compelling piece of history, which just demands to be read. If there ever has been a history that is so, so important, so, so topical, so, so significant, I suppose it's this, especially with how America and China and the rest of the world are posturing. It just demands to be read. Thank you for sharing all that with us, David. Is there anything you'd like to finish with before we say goodbye and bid you farewell so you can go and carry on with more research?
You are way too kind, Patrick. But I've really loved the conversation and the questions and your interest. And I would just encourage listeners, as I suspect many of the listeners already are engaged in the world and engaged in history, not just for the sake of history, but for the sake of improving the future. So I would just encourage people to get involved and especially in the struggle to make the world a more peaceful place.
Well, thank you very much indeed, David. We hope to invite you back to the podcast in the not too distant future from the publication of your next book. No pressure. You go and enjoy a fantastic day. Thank you so much for joining us on the Versus History podcast. On behalf of myself, the co-editors and the audience, it was absolutely sublime and superb. A tour de force. Have a wonderful day, David.
Thank you so much, Patrick. You too.
All the best.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.